Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder. I'm your host, Yucca, and
I'm Mark.
And this week, we are talking about depression.
One of the happier topics we'll address on this podcast.
Indeed. So I think we were going to start with the big question of, you know, what is depression?
Yes. For a lot of our listeners, this won't be a question at all because they experience it. They know what it is. But for the people that don't experience depression, there really is a need to define the difference between depression and just being sad. There are times when circumstances in our life lead us to be sad, and that's a perfectly reasonable response to those circumstances. In the case of tragedy, we can really be consumed by grief and be sad for a very long time. That's not the same thing as depression. Depression is a debilitating suppression of mood such that all of the functions of life are disrupted by the existence of the depression. So appetite is either suppressed or enhanced to the point where people are binge eating. Sleep patterns get disturbed. Concentration becomes very difficult. Memory is affected. And most of all, initiative is affected because the neurotransmitter dopamine is suppressed under depression. And that is the get up and go neurotransmitter that leads us to be able to, you know, stand up, get out of bed, go take a shower, go to the gym, go do something, right? Mm-hmm. And with low levels of that neurotransmitter, we will just stay lying around in bed, not doing very much, sometimes for very long periods of time. So depression is a brain state. And the problem with it is that it is this kind of double whammy of lack of initiative and inability to feel joy. Which is a condition called anhedonia. And that has to do with the fact that in depression, also the neurotransmitter serotonin, which is the pleasure neurotransmitter, is also suppressed in the brain. And so what happens is that there's a structure in the brain called the hippocampus, which will actually shrink because of the lack of serotonin. And when it is shrunk, you are physically unable to feel enjoyment in doing things that you used to enjoy. The paradox of depression is often that doing the very things that you need to do in order to get yourself out of it are the things that you can't make yourself do and that don't feel good when you do them. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible, terrible condition. I've lived with it since I was 7. And I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Not that I really have any, but if I did, I wouldn't wish it on them.
It's often goes hand in hand with anxiety, which I don't know if that's something we want to touch on a little bit as well.
Yes, that's true. And anxiety is, it goes well with depression because it's this sort of churning electric sense that you must do something while at the same time, because you're depressed, you can't do anything. So the stress level of the anxiety continues to ramp up. And that of course then can affect sleep patterns and appetite and relationships and jobs and all
the spiral goes.
Exactly. All those things. And so, you know, your internal narrative turns into this kind of poisonous self-critical storytelling about yourself, about the world, about humanity, about the future, especially. It's always going to be this way. Nothing can ever get better. All that kind of stuff. So yes, anxiety is definitely a part of the formula there. And for many people that suffer from depression, they also suffer from anxiety.
Hmm.
So it is estimated that something like 20% of the people in the world experience depression, at least at some point in their lives. And
again, talking about true depression, not a period of I'm sad, but the,
yes,
yeah,
yes, the, this paralytic, personality changing, life disrupting incapacity to contend with the level of sorrow and sadness and pain that one feels. So that's what it is. It's no fun. It's just not any fun at all. But the reason that we wanted to talk about it today was to talk about not only what it is, and what our own experiences of it have been in our lives and how we've, you know, helped to make that better. But then also we'd like to go into how our pagan practice has helped us to step up out of depressive episodes in the past. So one of the reasons that we picked this this particular topic is that on the day that we're recording, which is the 4th of July, that is the 38th anniversary of a time that I watched a full lunar eclipse from the walled enclosure of a mental hospital here in Sonoma County. I had cut my wrists and I had been 5450'd against my will. They put me in this mental hospital and I spent a week there. It's the only time that's ever happened, but it was a pretty eye-opening experience in many ways. And it certainly didn't make the depression go away or even help much with that, but it was a milestone that let me know that something was really wrong and that I had to go and figure out how to fix it. Mm. So it's been a pretty long road over the last 38 years. That's a long time. And I can go into more about how I've gotten to the state that I'm in now, which I congratulate myself to believe is a better one. I'd also like to hear about your experience, Yucca.
Depression and anxiety and the balance between the two has changed over the years. Really, defined a lot of my later teen years and early 20s. That was a time period of a lot of extremes where it was something that I would fall very deep into, and kind of come out of in a full run and then fall back into. And I'm very happy to say that it's something that has really shifted for me in the last decade, that it's something that does still, that I can feel approaching. And there's a lot of things that I do now to really help with that. And when it does start to crop back up, it is definitely the anxiety side, which is the part that I still struggle more with. But there were some pretty major changes that I made on a lifestyle level that really helped for me. And then getting the support that I didn't have in the time period where it was the hardest for me. But having that incredible, loving, nurturing support now that my partner provides for me and we do for each other has really changed and shifted things. So I don't know if as we go through the episode, we might talk a little bit about what some of those different techniques have been. Mm-hmm. But very, you know, it's cliche to say, but literally life-changing. where it feels like I'm a different person now, you know, than I was then, that it just feels completely different to be me.
Yes. Yeah, I concur with that as well. I mean, obviously for me, it's been a very long time. And people do change over the course of their lives, but I was a right mess when I was in my late teens into my mid 20s or so. I was just, when I think about just what a mess I was, it's kind of shocking to me, really. It seems like I'm thinking about someone else. So, where should we go from here? Shall we talk about how we got out, or shall we talk about how our practices dovetailed with that? Or
at least for me, those two are going to be very hard to tease apart which is which. I think they're so connected in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll say a bit about how I got out. The hospital was not a step up. It was, it was a wake up call, but it was not a step up at all. And I went through, let me see, then I was 20, and it wasn't until I was 27 that things really turned around for me. But over the period from when I was 24 to 27, I was in a relationship, very loving, very supportive, very kind, very conscious relationship. And I also had a series of experiences with MDMA, which, are you familiar, Yucca, with what that is?
No, what was that?
I had a series of experiences with MDMA. The drug?
Okay. No, I'm not familiar with.
Okay. Ecstasy or Molly are the slang terms for it. It's what's being used in PTSD studies now with veterans coming home. Essentially what this drug does is it wrings all of the serotonin out of your brain at once. So you experience this tremendous joy that lasts for about 6 hours. And you see yourself as a luminous and perfect being. You see the people around you as luminous and perfect beings. You see the world as a beautiful and perfect place. And the great thing about that is that when it wears off, you remember all that stuff. Once you've seen, you can't unsee. And those experiences showed me that this noise in my head was lying to me. That, you know, it spoke very authoritatively and it was always right. And it had an argument for everything that I put up against it, but it was still full of shit. So the combination of that relationship and those experiences really helped me to be in a very, very different place going into my 30s. And it's gotten rocky at times when, you know, I had a divorce, things like that, that are hard. But I've had a couple of serious bouts since, but it's been nothing like it was back in those days. And now I have medications. There's finally a medication cocktail that works absolutely well for me. I don't feel depression at all. For the first time in my life. And that's been happening now for 4 years. So long trip, but kind of like where I landed. So let's talk about practices. It's interesting to me that right at the time when I first got involved with paganism was right around the time when I was starting that relationship that I talked about. So it's kind of hard for me to tease apart how having a ritual life that helped me to feel connected spiritually and like there was a logic to my existence and having a place in the universe, all of those pieces and celebrating the natural world, came along at about the same time as all those other things. So
that relationship was the other person part of the kind of pagan scene that you were entering into, or it was just happened to coincide at the same time?
It just happened to coincide. She was not. She was 11 years older than me. So we had really almost no overlap in terms of social circles, life experience, any of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's a very beautiful relationship. Went on for 3 years, and then I was grown up enough to be able to live, and she was at a point in her life where she wanted to settle down and have kids, and I was just like, no, not there yet. Don't think I'm ever going to be there for kids. And that was the end of it, which was a shame, but very important time in my life. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about practices and how they can work to help us with depression and anxiety.
Well, I'm going to start with a pretty common theme for me is talking about the connecting back in with our natural cycles as animals, where we have an internal clock that is guiding what's happening with our bodies on a hormonal level from a day-to-day basis. But then that clock, of course, is influencing us on a more seasonal scale and on a lifetime scale as well. And one thing that happens, this is a particular challenge in our modern culture, I think for everyone, but especially with some of the depression and anxiety, is that we get our hormonal cycles are just off. They're out of set, out of sync. They're, you know, firing at the wrong time, too much of something at the wrong time, not enough of the right. You're not getting what you need to be able to build you're not making enough of the precursors, and, you know, it becomes a pretty complex process, but a big step is trying to balance that out in some of the really simple ways that we have that for me made a big difference. The getting sunlight was a huge, huge first step. And sometimes at that time period, I was a student who worked, you know, working full time in school, full time, pretty much indoors, and hard to get myself to be outside, but that made the biggest difference, is getting outdoors in the morning on a consistent basis. And that just starting with that was that snowballed, really. It made such a big impact all the way down for the rest of, if I could do that one thing, right? The one thing of being outdoors in the morning sun in my eyes and just getting into that pattern. And that today, I mean, it continues. You know, you've all heard me talk about my sun time and star time, and that's what it has morphed into. But it started as I've just got to get my hormones working with the day. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
it's very common for people who experience depression to have very suppressed vitamin D levels. It's not uncommon for psychiatrists to prescribe vitamin D, mm-hmm. Among other things. And of course we get vitamin D from being in the sun.
Yeah. Well, I know for myself from that time period, with blood tests from then, I am, if anyone ever seen a picture of me, I am on the pastiest side of pasty possible. Like I don't have pigment in my skin and I can't tan, like it doesn't work. But even, and living in the desert, I was way too low with my vitamin D levels. And of course, there's a lot involved with that as well in terms of the other foods that you're eating, whether your body can even use it once you make it and all of that. But it makes a huge difference. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a very sensible approach. I'm glad that you stumbled onto it. Was it a deliberate choice, or was it, did you learn about that from somewhere, or was it just a discovery that you made?
Personality wise, I'm like a research everything kind of person. Hmm. So I went down some research rabbit hole at one point, and I'm also a kind of throw myself all in sort of person. When I decide that something is the way to, that I'm going to try it out, then I'm going to go all the way with it. So, yeah, that was, and that, you know, there was a lot more steps as well, but that, just talking about practices, especially ones that tie into our pagan practices, that was a huge starter for me, is that just connecting back in with the cycles that our ancestors evolved with. You know, we have millions of generations who did that before us, you know, way back before we were ever even humans, before we were ever even mammals. This is what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Until we messed it up with artificial light.
Yeah. That's a biggie.
Yeah. So yeah. Part of the way that my practice has benefited me in times of depression has been that I keep a focus or altar in my room, and it sort of talks to me. It kind of reminds me all of this is still out there. You know, you may not be very able to do very much right now, but it's all still out there. You know, this rich, you know, beautiful life full of wonder is still there. And that has made a big difference to me. And even if it's been, you know, on the days, like the last time that I had a very serious depressive bout was, well, it was before I started taking the meds. So it was about 5 years ago, I would say. And I was in bed for months, unable to work, unable to do anything. And still on the good days, on the days when I could get up and I could take a shower and eat something and those things, there was always something that I was doing, futzing around on my altar, just something, whatever it was, changing the symbols of the seasons or rearranging things or whatever it was. And it was, some of it was just doing something creative, because creativity really dries up when you're depressed, and doing something creative feels really amazing then. But some of it was also just reacquainting myself with, this is a dimension of you too. It's not dead. It's not over. You just can't access it right now. And having enough maturity, I guess, to recognize that and not go into this, you know, oh, woe is me, it's all terrible, it's never going to be good again kind of thing that I used to when I was younger, it would get me through. It would get me to a point where I could at least go and seek some help. And then I hit the jackpot medically. So many people, neurochemistry is so individual. People try different medications and they don't work for them, and it's really a challenge. The first medication that they tried perked me up about 80%. They added another, and that got me to about 90%. And then that one was like 85%. But then the third in the cocktail really put me at 100. It just, the combination of the three has stomped the depression down, and I have not experienced depression since.
How did you recognize that you could go higher? Had you had the good places before that you knew?
Yes,
that you could
I had.
To?
Okay. I knew what not being depressed felt like, although before the medications, I was always so prone to it that it wouldn't take very much to send me into a spiral. Mm-hmm. I resisted medication for decades. And the story that I told myself was, well, then you won't be you anymore. You'll be somebody mm-hmm. else. You'll be some sort of lobotomized version of you. And the reality is, I am more fully me now than I've ever been able to be before, because I've actually got enough dopamine to do the stuff that is in me. Mm-hmm. I've been extraordinarily lucky. I know people that have really suffered and have tried medication after medication, and they've had terrible side effects and all this kind of stuff. I have some side effects, but I can live with them.
Well, it seems like there's a pretty big stigma still with using medications.
Yeah. And for that reason, I lead with it. I'm having nothing. I'm just not having the stigma of mental illness. I'm not. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will talk with anybody about the fact that I have mental illness. It's a combination of genetic factors and environmental factors. Its onset was very, very early. Maybe if I'd had a loving and supportive family, it wouldn't have happened, but I didn't. And so it did. Mm-hmm. And it's not a character flaw. It's not a moral failure.
Well, I think it's so important. So thank you, right, for being open about it, because like you said, 20%, that's a lot of people.
It's a huge number of people. And so many suffer in silence because they're so ashamed of what it implies about them if they acknowledge that they are depressed. Because we have this catch-all term called crazy, mm-hmm. and everybody's afraid of it.
Or the judgment that you're just not trying hard enough.
Oh, yes, there's that too.
Right? Oh, you're just be happy.
Just go take a walk.
Just relax. Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, any of those prescriptions that begin with just, you can pretty well throw. Go for a walk. You'll feel better. I can't get out of bed. I would love to go for a walk. Yeah. But I can't move. I mean, I literally remember during that last many months long depression, sitting up in bed and thinking, I should get dressed, and looking down at my hands. Okay, hands, now we're going to take the covers off, and then we're going to get up and we're going to go and get dressed. And I remember staring at my hands, and I stared at my hands for about a half an hour, and I could not make them do what needed to happen in order for me to go and get dressed. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can explain that in general terms. I can't explain it in specific terms. How can it be? You know, I was moving my hands. I just could not take myself to the level of activity of being able to move.
Hmm.
So, yeah, weird stuff.
Yeah.
Really weird stuff. And all kinds of weird stuff. Sleep disturbance and just, you know, brain chemistry will do stuff to you. That's why people drink and take drugs and take up jogging.
I'm amazed for the people that works for. I hear it. People have talk about the runner's high and all, and I've tried. that's not my body. So.
I did run for a while, and I did actually get to the point where I started to experience the runner's high. But at the same time, I had a torn meniscus in my knee that was more and more and more and more and more painful. So I eventually gave up on it. I don't think running is good for you. I mean, sprinting maybe. I think ancestrally we probably had to move pretty fast once in a while in order to save our skins. But walking, I think, is much more our natural thing mm-hmm. to do. Just the bouncing up and down and compressing the discs of the spine, does not, yeah. you know, and then bouncing this big 20-pound bowling ball that's perched on top of our necks around, it just doesn't seem very healthy to me from a skeletal muscular standpoint.
Well, then the surfaces that we're running on are totally different than they were in the past. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So that's our thumbnail critique of jogging. I hope that no one is offended. If you're a runner, good for you. Enjoy.
I admire the people who are, who that works for. There's other movement that works for my body, but that just isn't.
Uh-huh.
This
is
one of them.
Yeah.
I swim, actually.
Oh, good.
That works really well for me.
Uh-huh.
But that hasn't been happening in the last few months.
Well, you've been a little busy.
Yeah, well, and the a lot of the
pool. Oh, and the COVID, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, since you don't have your own pool. In fact, you're having catchment for your water.
You know, one day maybe I'll turn that into a pool.
Okay.
If right?
You have enough water.
Oh, yeah, no, it's the material, though, of doing something long, and, you know, you got to get narrow and long. It's easy. It's way easier to make a circle.
Yeah, I guess.
So
yeah, I can see how that would be.
But we're going off on a tangent.
We're way far afield now. So
you talked about the altar. Are there other things that really helped for your process?
Getting outside was important. Even if it was just sitting on a chair immediately outside my house, breathing some fresh air, hearing some birds, all of those things, they were comforting in a way because they reminded me that the world was still going on. That, you know, this tragedy / nightmare that I had going on in my head was just my head's nightmare. It wasn't anything that had washed across the entire planet and made everything awful. So it was another way of corroborating that depression lies, which is a really important lesson for anyone who struggles with depression to learn. Depression just lies like a bastard. Mm-hmm. It just whispers all this yuck in your ear all day long, and you have to ignore it. You have to learn to tune it out, and not rise to the bait. Mm-hmm. And it always sounds like the most authoritative voice you can imagine. It's absolutely certain of itself. Yeah. So depression lies. And when you go outside and there are trees and wind and birds, clouds,
mm-hmm.
makes it harder to be depressed.
Different temperatures.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I have created a couple of rituals that I've used when I've kind of been emerging from depression and I've been able to move a little bit more. There's a couple of them on the atheopaganism.org website. One of them's called The Jewel. And then the other is the Atheopagan Rosary, which is, you know, done with beads, which is a cool project to do anyway. It's fun. Hmm. But they're about self-love and love for the world and being able to see the beauty and hold the paradox, to be able to not be perfect, to be flawed and have that be fine.
Mm-hmm.
All of those were very hard-won lessons on my part, and I didn't let go of them easily. That idea of having to be perfect, or that I was garbage, or that the world had to be perfect, or it was horrible. Sitting with paradoxical truths, I think, is one of the hallmarks of an adult. Because we have to all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so my adventures with depression have kind of helped me to draw some of those conclusions.
Mm.
So right about now is when I should say that if you are suffering with depression and you need help, you should go to your local NAMI hotline. That's the National Association for the Mentally Ill. And they tend to have hotlines and other resources for people that are struggling, or call suicide prevention wherever you are. People are there because they want to hear from you. They want to talk to you. And don't do this alone. The isolating thing is the first impulse when you're depressed, and it is absolutely contrary to your best interests. It's one of the things that depression lies about, that you're unworthy to have other people's company.
Especially when the anxiety is in there too, the social anxiety of being able to ask for the help.
Yes.
Right.
You feel like you can't even make eye contact with anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, it's quite a ride.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that is, you know, one of those easier said than done things that helped me tremendously was coming to accept that I had a different neurotype and that that was okay. Right. And learning what does my brain need? Not what do I think it should, because that's how everybody else is. And being able to start to see, to some extent, I'd have to push myself to get past my comfort zone, because that comfort zone shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink, but that it's also okay to have a different level of people tolerance, and that it's okay to have practices when you have been around people. At least for me, you know, I have a person tolerance, and I have to go and have a decharge after that, or a distress, de-stress. Yeah. Of taking a shower or running the water or being around some sort of white noise afterwards, and learning that that's not a bad thing. That's an okay thing. It helps me to function. And there's lots of other practices that, you know, most people have that is socially acceptable for them to do. And this is just my version of that.
Sure.
Know, right. Sure. You know, there's some people, you know, turn on the game and get out a beer, and that's what helps them to relax. And, but if that doesn't help me, that's okay. I don't have to do that. I can do the thing that does seem to help, and to let go of that judgment around it.
Yes. Yes. I have a very mixed sense of the word neurotypical. And I mean, folks in the mental illness field will often talk about people that are atypical versus people that are neurotypical, particularly folks that are on the autism spectrum. They'll talk about, you know, we're atypical, we're on the spectrum, and so we're different from neurotypical people in ways XYZ. I'm sure that's true. I'm also not sure I've ever met anybody that was neurotypical.
Mm-hmm.
I think brains are like fingerprints.
Mm-hmm.
And for people that don't have dysfunctions like a propensity for depression, they may not, the cultural way of doing things may work fine for them, which is why they're our culture, right? Because they work for most people most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least people can accept them most of the time, like going to work for 40 hours, 50 hours a week, because it's normal.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't worry very much about whether I'm normal or not anymore. especially because the people that I really value most in the world, none of them are normal.
Mm-hmm.
They're all strange and wonderful. and I love them. And so I, you know, the quest for normality has been abandoned on my part, but, yes, that whole, we should be normal thing. That's, it's as pernicious as I have to be perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and just knowing that, you know, with just knowing that you, that other ways can work.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, we see people who are adapting to whatever their challenges are in a wide variety of ways all the time. We see danger seekers. We see alcoholics. We see, you know, people who, you know, they're self-medicating themselves with adrenaline or with alcohol or with whatever else in order to feel okay. And some of those are considered to be in the normal bucket and some of them aren't. So I still think it's kind of an arbitrary call. But nobody ever really accused me of being normal anyway. So having abandoned the quest just feels better.
I don't think I've had that accusation levied at me either. Now, although in younger years, it was a challenge for, you know, people being critical.
Sure.
Being too different or not right or those things, which I think that the details are different, but that's unfortunately a very familiar story for most people, I think.
Well, the teen years are the years when we're learning social behavior. We're kind of modeling on adults, and so conformity becomes super important. And anybody who's non-conforming gets turned on in a major way. So, I mean, I guess that's kind of inevitable, but it didn't make it any less painful.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that we wanted to touch on?
You know, I don't think so. Want to remind everybody that we can be reached at thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. And we welcome your input and your questions and like to hear from you. So that's always really great. We will put the website for NAMI in the post notes, so people have access to that information as well. I guess what I most want to say is stay strong and stay safe.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again next time.